president has indicated that he has no intention of firing Mueller or Rosenstein. Grassley's answer was, "If there's a bipartisan bill brought to me, I would put it out there for passage." Say what? This is a waste of taxpayer dollars in the make-believe Russia collusion saga, and yet the Senate judiciary wants to let it pass? Whose side is he on? Mueller is a special hire of the Justice Department, which is part of the executive branch. Every single person who works in the executive branch ultimately reports to the president. President Trump and Vice President Pence are the only two people elected out of approximately 2 million employees in the executive branch, not counting uniformed military. So, no, firing a subordinate would not be a constitutional crisis, regardless of what the bill's proponents say. Let's not forget how this all started. Republican Senator John McCain dispatched former State Department official David Cramer to London to retrieve the infamous Russian dossier from Christopher Steele. Cramer now works at Arizona State University's Washington-based McCain Institute for International Leadership. But it was McCain who handed the dossier over to the FBI and then decried release of the Putin memo as doing Putin's job for him. Is that the extent of his involvement with the dossier? We don't know. There were rumors circulating before the House closed its investigation about McCain possibly being more involved, perhaps even helping to fund the dossier himself. The House Intelligence Committee subpoenaed Cramer to ask further questions, but he took the fifth, which means that he believed testifying on this subject to the House might have tended to incriminate him. What crime was he afraid of being charged with? We'll never know. The House has closed its investigation into Russia's interference in the election, and it's unlikely that Cramer will be called by Mueller. If we ever got real justice, the conspirators trying to overturn the 2016 election would be the ones on trial. On top of all the other reasons to thank Donald Trump for leaving a rather comfortable, happy life to run for president, saving us from enduring yet another rhino Republican nominee, has to be high on the list. Let's not forget, low-energy Jeb Bush was once a front-runner, at least in terms of fundraising, in the race for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination. Jeb was all set up to either be the next George W. Bush or lose to Hillary, with real conservatives having no voice in the election at all. It's almost hard to believe at this point, but yes, the party might have nominated another milquetoast rhino had it not been for Donald Trump's epic destruction of Jeb's campaign in a debate in South Carolina with the audience packed with Bush loyalists. Only Donald Trump could have pulled this off. Can you imagine any other Republican, any other politician, having the balls to say the Iraq War was a colossal mistake in front of a hostile crowd in South Carolina? When the crowd began to boo, Trump didn't back up an inch. He told the television audience, "Do you know who that is? That's Jeb's special interests and lobbyists talking." When the packed audience continued to try to shout him down, Trump confronted them directly, saying, "I only tell the truth, lobbyists." What Jeb's jeering supporters didn't understand, what the entire establishment has never understood, is that Donald Trump is a force of nature. The same heat that would burn others feeds him. For any other candidate, taking on the media is suicide. Donald Trump checkmated them. Whether it's real estate, entertainment, or politics, he is not afraid to jump into the fire. His message is always uniquely his own. He understands people, and he sees things that other people don't see. He is not afraid to take positions that would make others cringe. The attacks in any presidential campaign are vicious, brutal, and lightning fast. the kind of heat the average person simply can't take. What Donald Trump does, he generally does against all odds. A brash billionaire from New York City candidate for president? You must be kidding. So began the campaign of the most unlikely outsider presidential candidate in American history. They all underestimated Trump, even ridiculed him. But what they couldn't comprehend was the difference between him and the other 16 establishment candidates. This guy named Trump was fearless and had the guts to walk into a den of lions and come out the winner. For all intents and purposes, Jeb's campaign was effectively over after that debate, and the Bushes certainly haven't forgotten it. They're part of the rhino stampede from the sidelines. Many of the Bush people are the ones on TV and in print attacking this president, says Kellyanne Conway. They weren't well known when working for President Bush, but they tried to become rich and famous working against President Trump. It's ironic, because they know how unfair the press can be. Yet, it's unsurprising. President Trump upended two political dynasties, Clinton and Bush, and is compared most with Reagan. The conservative movement was always looking for the next Reagan, and they kept picking Bushes. Jeb was out before South Carolina. Later, Hillary cratered. Out, dynastic elections. In, forgotten men and women. The Bushes can yap all they want about their dislike for Donald Trump. Nobody cares. While we still have to fight to ensure a Democrat doesn't win the White House in 2020, at least we know it won't be occupied by a phony rhino Republican thanks to Donald Trump. Now it's time to turn our attention to Congress this November. Chapter 5. Liberal Sanctuary Cities. She was a pretty 32-year-old with blonde hair and a bright smile. He was a dirtbag, illegal alien, and career criminal, a drug dealer with 7 felony convictions and 5 deportations under his belt. She was walking along a San Francisco pier on a sunny day with her dad. He had been released from jail a few months before. She had just met the love of her life, a handsome young lawyer whom she planned to marry. He pulled the trigger of a stolen .40 caliber Sig Sauer handgun, the bullet piercing the pretty blonde's heart. She had everything to live for. He had no right to be there. She said, "Help me, Dad," as she lay dying in her father's arms. The day Jose Inez Garcia Zarate shot Catherine Katie Steinle to death, he was supposed to be in the custody of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, or on his way back to Mexico. He wasn't. Instead, he was walking the streets of San Francisco, thanks to liberal San Francisco Sheriff Ross Mirkarimi. 3 months before Katie was killed, the feds had asked the sheriff to keep Garcia Zarate in jail until they could pick him up for deportation. But in the sanctuary of San Francisco, the sheriff thought it was better to let him go free. Tell me how much of a sanctuary San Francisco was for Katie. While the deep state continues its assault on President Trump, liberal politicians and the fake press continue to undermine his policies. Nowhere is this more evident than with so-called sanctuary cities. Somewhere around the time that Donald Trump announced his presidency, the fake news decided to tell you that criminal, illegal immigrant, and immigrant meant the same thing. Here's the narrative they disseminated. Do you have a problem with criminal, illegal immigration? Then you hate illegal immigrants. Think illegal immigration laws should be enforced? Then you hate immigrants. Think all immigration policies should be fairly enforced? You hate immigrants and you are a racist. The press didn't have to work hard to get their point across. In fact, they were preaching to the choir. Liberals have their heads so far up their asses, they care more about criminals than innocent victims. And they look down their noses at anyone who thinks differently from them. They can be holier than thou because most of the interaction they have with illegals is when they get their lawns mowed. You don't see a whole lot of liberals in South Texas or along the Mexican border of Arizona screaming about how unfair our immigration policies are, unless they are the illegals themselves. You know why? Because if they lived there, they would be helping build the wall themselves. But let President Trump tell the unvarnished truth about illegal immigration and criminality, and they go apoplectic. This has been true since the first time the president talked about illegal immigration as a presidential candidate. The speech that saved our borders. On June 16, 2015, Donald Trump gave maybe the most memorable speech announcing a presidential run in the history of politics. The liberal press was outraged because of these words. They're sending people that have lots of problems. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. In the next few days, the geniuses on liberal editorial boards predicted the shortest campaign in history. Trump is done, the headlines blared. Hollywood blew a fuse, and stars lined up to take shots at Donald. Macy's dropped the Trump clothing line. People couldn't wait to stomp on his campaign's grave. But guess what? Not everybody is liberal. In fact, most of the country isn't. Do you know what the rest of the country thought of Donald Trump's first campaign speech? It's about time someone had the balls to say it. You think I'm wrong? Well, then tell me what happened to Donald Trump's campaign following that speech. Was he done? Was his the shortest campaign ever? No. In fact, that speech started a movement that blazed a trail right to the White House. Okay. I'll give you this. Sometimes the president isn't as politically correct as liar Obama, but isn't it refreshing to finally be able to listen to someone who says what he thinks? To hell with political correctness. A nation exhausted after 8 years of Obama's "I say what I mean and mean what I say" double talk, we're starving for the straight talk Trump delivered. Sometimes his wording is a little rough around the edges, but Donald Trump feels the way much of America feels, and that's why he was elected our president. Does Donald Trump hate immigrants? No, absolutely not. His wife is an immigrant who speaks with an accent. While doing a street justice segment, the Trump Tower employees I spoke with who have foreign accents talked about what a great employer he is. Calling him anti-immigrant is the equivalent of calling him un-American. And the American people know Donald Trump loves this country. The man had to go to court to fight for his right to fly as big an American flag as he wanted at Mar-a-Lago. Being 100% pro-immigration does not, however, mean our borders should be open to people who want to break the law or take advantage of the American system. Trump is a populist who understands the frustrations of the American people. Illegal immigration affects the least fortunate Americans more than it does anyone else. Those at the bottom of the ladder should not be undercut by cheap, illegal labor. Nor should illegal immigrants be released into the community after committing crimes against American citizens. The president understands that immigration into our country should be based on fairness, the needs of the American economy, and the safety of both American citizens and legal immigrants, rather than family unification or proximity to our borders. The sanctuary state. There are more than 300 sanctuary cities in the United States where government employees and local law enforcement are prevented from reporting and sharing information on illegal immigrants. When their police arrest an illegal immigrant for felonies or fine them for misdemeanors, They don't turn them over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, even if the illegal, like Garcia Zarate, is a career criminal. And now, the state of California, as of January 1, 2018, has passed legislation making it a sanctuary state. In response, various cities and counties in California that face problems with illegal immigration have commenced litigation against the state of California. But California is not alone. Other sanctuary states include Colorado, Illinois, New Mexico, Oregon, and Vermont. Is this a new civil war in America? The federal unity of the 50 states versus the separate interest of several states? I believe in most matters the state should decide their own fates, but not where the safety of its citizens is outweighed by illegal criminal activity. Public safety is a fundamental right. The first order of government is the protection of its people. Emphasis, its. For over 100 years, the federal government has been entrusted with regulating immigration. But suddenly, in cities across this country, local law enforcement is releasing illegal aliens who have committed crimes back into the community after they serve their sentences and are released from jail as if they had any right to be there in the first place. They do this in total defiance of requests by federal ICE agents to hold the individual wanted for deportation or federal crime and without any constitutional grounding of their own. The term sanctuary city, when it comes down to it, is nothing more than an official-sounding phrase cooked up by local liberal politicians and members of city councils. It's never been written down in federal law or a court case of any consequence. The whole concept is a lie. To act or not to act. If you're a cop working in a sanctuary jurisdiction, then you're being directed by some left-wing liberal, progressive mayor, county executive, or governor to protect criminals who are illegal, who not only violated our laws in coming here, but committed additional crimes while here. You're being told not to share any information about illegal criminals and not to honor federal ICE detainers. So, you've got a decision to make. And if this is a tough one for you, and you can't figure out what your sworn obligation is, then I suggest you get the hell out of law enforcement. Think back to the day you graduated from the academy, when you got a badge and a gun. You earned the right to protect us. We trusted that you understood your mission. We were proud of you, proud to count you as part of that blue wall that every day separates a civilized society from a chaotic and barbaric one. Your job? To protect the innocent, follow the truth, arrest the criminal, be true to your oath. That oath is not negotiable. It is not for sale, and neither are you. You knew this when you signed up, and no namby-pamby, bleeding-heart, left-wing socialist political whore has the right to demand that you defy that oath. If you don't have the courage to do what you know needs to be done, then you don't deserve to wear that badge. How many innocent Americans do we need to lose to deported illegals who come back to the U.S. and go on to kill? Every politician who ordered you not to cooperate with federal authorities has blood on their hands. You would never allow an American criminal to roam freely in your jurisdiction if another law enforcement agency asked you to hold them. Why is it different for illegal aliens? Why do these criminals have protections American criminals don't? It's absurd. If you release him, you guarantee fellow officers or agents are going to be in harm's way when they go out to find him. To be clear, most are not talking about calling the illegals, simply working in the fields, waiting tables, babysitting, or cleaning houses. We're talking about criminals who pose a clear threat to American citizens. So what to do? You notify ICE as soon as you can. And I don't care what you must do to get that done. If you must do it quietly, anonymously, behind closed doors, underground, through a special hotline email or carrier pigeon, damn it, just do it. You instinctively understand danger. It's in your DNA. If you have an MS-13 gang member whose initiation you know requires that he beat someone to death or rape someone in front of fellow gang members, and you don't tell ICE, you have blood on your hands. Americans have the right to know when they are in danger. Why would you treat an illegal criminal different than an American criminal? Hell, maybe law-abiding states should clear out their prisons and send their own criminals to sanctuary states. Since they're open to taking other countries' criminals, the least they can do is take ours. Think of the money we could save not jailing them. Can't you see that you're being used in a political tug of war? If this is a tough one for you, and you're going to start listening to the ACLU or some liberal mayor who doesn't give a damn about you, your contract, or your oath, when they direct you to release the wanted criminal alien out the side door, then maybe you should rethink this and go into social work. As of this writing, the state of California is locked in a legal fight with the United States of America, trying to defend its right to ignore federal law. Only they're arguing from the opposite direction. Sure, they say the federal government has jurisdiction over immigration, but in this case, we're going to do everything we can to make it impossible for them to enforce it. Newsflash. The United States Constitution Supremacy Clause can't be set aside because California or Colorado, New Mexico, Oregon, Illinois, Vermont, or the Queen of England says it should be. That's why it works. States do not get to make their own rules that fly in the face of our founding documents so they can appease liberal voters and ensure liberal politicians stay in office for a few more terms. There's a new sheriff in town who actually cares about our founding principles and won't stand by while they're ignored and mocked. Democrats' priority is to protect criminals, not to do what's right for our country, President Trump said recently. My priority and the priority of my administration is to serve, protect, and defend the citizens of the United States. Just as it should be, Mr. President. But not everyone feels the same way, apparently. Liberal Libby Schaaf is the Democratic mayor of Oakland, California. She's one of the people currently involved in the lawsuit between California and the United States. In February 2018, she decided that the courts weren't the only place that she and her state would go after lawful federal processes. She decided to send out a message to illegals herself. This message came in the form of a tweet, a public document, which will someday be admissible as evidence. The tweet warned that ICE was about to conduct an illegal immigration sweep throughout Northern California, including Oakland. She cried, "The feds are coming! The feds are coming!" The sweep, of course, was something ICE was well within its rights to do. The tweet foiled the operation, sent the immigrant community in that city into a panic, and left some 800 illegal immigrant criminals, including violent ones with violent felony convictions that include rape, domestic violence, pedophilia, larceny, burglary, and assault on the streets. Betrayal. She put her concerns for people who are in this country illegally and who have committed crimes while here ahead of the safety of the people of Oakland. ICE was able to detain 232 illegal immigrants over the 4 days after the mayor's tweet. According to Tom Homan, the acting director of ICE, out of those 232, 115 had prior felony convictions of serious and violent offenses. But the ones that got away are still out there. In the weeks that followed the tweet, at least 3 of those 800 illegal immigrants who had criminal records that included drug possession hit and runs and spousal abuse, committed new serious crimes. One was a robbery with gun charges. Being a law enforcement officer is already dangerous enough. Giving the criminals a heads up that cops are coming for you should be a jailable offense. So the question is, do we protect illegals who flouted our laws to come here, who committed crimes while here, or law-abiding American citizens who should be able to live safely without sanctioned criminals in their midst? You can march and you can hate and you can demonize the 45th president, but mayors like liberal Bill de Blasio in New York, liberal Rahm Emanuel in Chicago, and liberal Libby Schaff in Oakland, who say their policies only improve relations between the immigrant community and law enforcement, are now effectively removing law enforcement protection from American citizens and legal immigrants. Proud to be an American. Donald Trump has launched a new era in American history that will last for decades. It's called Americanism. He is announcing our agenda of America First, the safety and security of her citizens, her allies, and her interests here and abroad. The liberal left, both here and across the globe, are doing everything they can to destroy both his vision and our way of life. We finally have a leader who understands the need to take care of us, to do what's in America's interest. Our NATO, so-called allies, acting like children refusing to leave mommy and daddy's basement, should be on notice. They can no longer despise us, take advantage of us, and reap the benefits of our largesse. But like spoiled children, they continue to kick and scream. Thanks to Trump's leadership, they are finally starting to pay their way. My own cases prove sanctuary cities don't work. Liberals believe that if illegal immigrants don't have to fear being found out and deported, they'll be more likely to engage with the community or report crimes when they are victims or witnesses. It almost makes sense when you hear it for the first time. But it doesn't work. 32 years as a prosecutor, judge, and DA in a county of about a million tells me that. As evidence, consider a case handled by my office when I was DA. It involved two illegals. The victim, Jose Martinez, was an illegal immigrant from Ecuador. He was a hard-working painter who was paid in cash every Friday. Almost every Friday, another illegal immigrant would assault him and steal his cash. One day, the other guy took a rock and smashed Jose's head in, killing him. Like most homicide victims, I only ever knew him through the cold lens of the camera, taking black and white autopsy photos. He was a small man with a big heart who simply wanted to work and take care of his family. Talking to Jose's family was a real eye-opener for me. They told me Jose had been afraid for his life, but was too scared to come forward. There is a law intended to provide illegal victims a safe haven and to encourage illegals to report crimes. This provides the sanctuary wacky leftists think they're creating. So in order to protect innocent illegals, we need to allow criminal illegals to roam freely to victimize citizens, legal aliens, and even other illegal aliens? That's what Jose was afraid of. In his mind, Westchester was already a sanctuary the criminal illegal was free to roam. Even if Westchester County was declared a sanctuary county and hung banners that said, "You're safe, we won't deport you," from every building in the county, Jose still wouldn't have come forward. Declaring communities sanctuary for illegal aliens sends a message to criminals that they will be protected and you won't. When liberal politicians enact laws protecting criminal illegals from deportation, all they're doing is further excusing these people from the rule of law. They're allowing criminal enclaves to form and fester and giving rise to all the shady codes of honor that come along with them. Why, when you are illegal yourself, would you report another illegal immigrant for beating you up and robbing you when you know he'll be right back on the street next week without fear of the police? Why would you say a word when the government can't send a lowlife like this guy back to where he came from? In order to get undocumented immigrants to cooperate with law enforcement, you do not need a blanket sanctuary city. The law is already in place. It's called a U visa. It's intended to encourage illegals to report crimes and provide them and their families a safe haven in America. I used it as DA. If you're illegal and you want to report a crime, this visa will protect you and give you and your family sanctuary from deportation. It's already the law. So in the end, sanctuary cities are nothing more than safe havens for criminal aliens and not their innocent victims, legal or illegal. Jose Inez Garcia Zarate came to San Francisco, where he shot and killed Kate Steinle, because it was a sanctuary city. He knew he wouldn't be deported, that he could continue his life of crime without fear of deportation or any substantial repercussions. And just to prove California is truly a sanctuary, irrespective of any legislation, a jury acquitted him of murder in spite of conflicting statements about where he found the gun. How many parents must lose their children? And now Mexico gets into the mix. They say that a wall and a crackdown on illegal immigrants is an affront to Mexico. They want us to have sanctuary cities. Really? So enough of this benign-sounding sanctuary city nonsense that protects criminals. At what point do we stop the killings and the violence? Why risk it all to protect criminal illegals? Who would it be okay to lose? Your son? Your mother? Or as Jim Steinle did, his daughter, who died in his arms after asking him to help her? To all those mayors like de Blasio in New York, Eric Garcetti in Los Angeles, and Muriel Bowser in Washington, D.C., who say they won't retreat from being sanctuary cities, my question to you is this. Who put you in office? Who did you take an oath to protect? Don't you understand that the first order of government is the protection of its citizens, American citizens? That's your job. Liberals, you have a decision to make. Are you willing to lose federal dollars that help pay for the cops in your city who protect American citizens and legal immigrants just to resist the deportation of criminals who are here illegally? Because that is where this is going. You cannot continue to accept federal money for law enforcement while at the same time doing everything you can to undermine federal law. Let me make one thing clear. We are all immigrants, except those of us who are Native American. But most of us came here under the rules. In fact, the happiest days for me as both district attorney and judge were when I welcomed newly naturalized citizens who worked hard to get here and pledged allegiance to our republic. But the concept of sanctuary cities is wrong, fundamentally flawed. Because of this mutinous refusal to follow federal law, you and your family are in real danger. So what to do? I'll tell you what to do. Enforce the law. If a city refuses to comply with federal warrants, they get no federal money. California gets $40 million a year to house criminal illegals until the feds pick them up. That's our money. Don't give me this have a heart nonsense. Americans are the most charitable, generous people on the face of the earth. But don't you dare ask us to create a zone of lawlessness and ignore the murder of innocent victims so some criminal here illegally won't have to go home. Don't tell me I have to be welcoming to people who break the law to come here. It's bad enough I must pay for their food, education, and medicine, but now I must bite my tongue and pretend to like it? I don't think so. I continue to believe a border wall is necessary in whatever form it may ultimately take. I want the wall so we can know who is in our country. I want the wall to prevent drugs from entering our country and our neighborhoods. Most of all, I want the wall to protect American lives. Anyone in law enforcement, especially in states on the border, will tell you the border wall is imperative to the safety and well-being of our citizens. So is the enforcement of federal laws. If you don't believe me, ask Kate Steinle's family. Chapter 6. Lying, Leaking Liberal Leadership. If you want to understand the constitutional crisis and attempted coup unfolding before our eyes, you must know how it originated. This plot against Donald Trump and every American who voted for him goes all the way to the top of the previous administration. It was conceived and planned at the top and executed by like-minded deep staters in law enforcement, the intelligence community, and their swamp party talking heads in the media. Allow me to introduce you to a few of the highest-ranking liars, leakers, and liberals involved in this scheme. Pond Scum Brennan. I can only imagine the joy the deep state experienced on Inauguration Day in 2009 when liar President Obama was sworn in. The intel community got a craven, malleable community organizer who would go along with their globalist plans as if he wrote them himself. Right off the bat, Obama's administration sent the message it could be talked into anything and was ready to work with anyone regardless of the damage to our country. It all began with his apology for being an American speech in Cairo, Egypt in January 2009, the first row filled with members of the Muslim Brotherhood, political arm of Hamas, picked by the Obama White House. The bottom line was Obama didn't have the balls to stand up to anyone. He was famous for boiling down his lead from behind foreign policy with the phrase, "Don't do stupid shit." If you can't beat him, join him would have been more appropriate. As luck would have it, he found a guide, someone who knew the swamp better than anyone else, and Obama wouldn't have to compromise his far-left ideology to accept this person's help. On the contrary, he might have to double down. His eventual CIA director and swamp guide, John O. Brennan, had once voted for Communist Party nominee Gus Hall in a U.S. presidential election. But that didn't stop Brennan from rising through the ranks of the Central Intelligence Agency. Far from it. Make no mistake, liberals control the deep state. Writing for National Review a few years back, Fred Flights, a retired CIA analyst, wrote how liberals had taken control of our intelligence agencies. According to Flights, who was vice president of the Center for Security Policy, a Washington think tank, the Clinton years were like a petri dish for the politicization of the CIA. The liberal tilt within the CIA, especially in the Directorate of Intelligence, the analysis office, grew worse during the Clinton years, as personnel were hired and promoted to support Clinton-Gore policy objectives, he wrote. Those policy objectives didn't seem to include keeping the United States safe from Osama bin Laden. By the time George W. Bush took office, Clinton's petri dish had become a biohazard waste dump, and W. didn't help matters any by retaining Clinton's CIA director, George Tenet. With the Clinton operatives burrowed in, the intelligence complex began to protect its liberal flanks. Flight cited several examples of the political maneuvering in the agency, including a CIA officer in Bush's inspector general's office leaking classified information about Bush's counterterrorism programs to the Washington Post, and intelligence officers trying to torpedo John Bolton's nomination as UN ambassador. Corruption in the intelligence community spread like mold. That's what happens when no one's looking. The days after 9/11, when the country was still shaken and vulnerable, presented the opportunity a career spook like John O'Brien waits for his whole life. He was an old boy from an old boys' club playing on the public sphere to seize powers they had failed to persuade the country to give them in saner times. In the mid-2000s, Liar Brennan was running counterterrorism operations for George W. Bush and likely dreaming about his chance to run the entire swamp the way most kids dream of becoming astronauts. Having crawled from under the same far-left rock and then been elected president, Liar Obama liked what he saw in Liar Brennan and named him the head of his CIA. Brennan's long and murky history in the intelligence complex made him the perfect reptile to work in Obama's swamp. The Brennan-Obama CIA became not only the most careless in the agency's history, but the least transparent. It was Brennan's CIA that spied on the Senate Intelligence Committee while that committee was investigating the CIA's detention and interrogation program. Not only did it read senators' emails, it sent a criminal referral to the Justice Department based on false information. So the FBI was just following established deep state protocol when it requested its FISA warrant to spy on the Trump campaign. In fact, the whole Russia collusion delusion was cooked up to get a wiretap on the campaign. By the time Brennan became CIA director, the post-9/11 American public had been relentlessly browbeaten into believing they had to give up their freedom for safety. To Congress and much of the public, the credibility of the CIA and NSA was unimpeachable. Exploiting this misplaced blind trust, Brennan's CIA wasn't just a cloak-and-dagger outfit. It was looking for someone to stab in the back. Obama gave Brennan's agency a million daggers and a black cloak with which to operate. When Donald J. Trump stormed past the other Republican candidates for president, his ascension shook the unelected career administrators, the power-hungry leadership in law enforcement, and the intelligence complex and the rest of the deep state. The threat that a Trump victory represented to their cabal was enough to set in motion a coordinated conspiracy to keep him out of the Oval Office. So it's no surprise Liar Brennan, working with another career bureaucrat across the Atlantic, James Bond wannabe Christopher Steele, started the whole phony Russian collusion investigation. It was Brennan who pressured the FBI into investigating the Trump campaign using Steele's comic book cobbled together from hearsay and rumor. It was Brennan who touted the now discredited dossier all over Washington as credible evidence. That comes as no surprise, but leaving aside for a moment that the bill for this piece of trash dossier was split three ways between Fusion GPS, the Hillary Clinton campaign, and the Democratic National Committee, conduct far more illegal than any Donald Trump is accused of, just think about who wrote the thing. Christopher Steele might as well be the British John Brennan. He's certainly every bit a liar and liberal. He climbed the ranks of posh British society without a hitch, went to Cambridge University, and then planted himself behind a desk at MI6 before the ink on his diploma was even dry. Within a few years, he was on the Russia desk, making friends in the Kremlin, and hanging out, you might even say colluding, with Russian officials whenever he got the chance. By the time he retired and launched his private practice, he was basically a Russian citizen. So, why did Steele take a piece of counterfeit opposition research and go to newspaper after newspaper trying to peddle it like a door-to-door insurance salesman? Why was he so insistent on it becoming a huge news story? He was supposed to be a spy. Isn't keeping your trap shut one of the core competencies of his profession? Apparently not in Mr. Steele's case, at least as far as this research was concerned. He couldn't wait to spill his guts to the liberal media. At least one source tells me the FBI paid him $50,000 for the dossier. Maybe he was just in it for the money. Was that why he rushed to Michael Isikoff of Yahoo News and David Korn at Mother Jones to tell his far-fetched story? Did he have dreams of a book deal and a Hollywood movie? Although his motives still aren't entirely clear, one thing is certain. Christopher Steele is not who the liberals say he is. He's not a top intelligence officer with impeccable credentials, a friend of the United States and a warrior for liberty. In fact, he's the exact opposite. He's a mercenary in a Harris tweed jacket and corduroy trousers hired out to the highest bidder. Liberals would have you believe the Russians are responsible for the political divide in our country. Newsflash, the Russian fake news stories placed on Facebook accounted for about 0.1% of Facebook advertising revenue. Now compare that pop gun to the Steele dossier dirty bomb that exploded in the media and has ever since poisoned us with a phony crisis of politically motivated investigation and a body politic more deeply divided than ever before. Mr. Steele's dossier caused real damage to the fabric of our nation, unlike Russia's insignificant meddling. And while our nation tore itself apart, Steele went underground in Great Britain. He lied to the Congressional Committee, lied to the FBI, and that's perjury. I don't care if he's from the UK or Mars. Actually, I do. We don't have an extradition treaty with Mars. And if Martha Stewart can go to jail for lying to the FBI and Roger Clemens can be indicted for lying to Congress, why not equal justice for the Brit? I think he needs to be brought back to the United States and prosecuted. Meanwhile, leaker Brennan conducted a campaign of disinformation by leaking false information about the Trump campaign's collusion with the Russians without a shred of evidence other than information from the discredited dossier itself. But this wasn't the first time Brennan abused the power and secrecy of his position to deceive the American people. Not even close. It was liar Brennan who helped put together the Obama administration's talking points to cover its deplorable handling of the Benghazi attack and crooked Hillary's complicity. It was leaker Brennan who had to apologize to U.S. senators for the CIA spying on their computers. And now, liberal Brennan will go to any length to disparage, slander, and sabotage the duly elected 45th president. Liar Brennan talks a tough game, but he's a snowflake at heart. Like his FBI friends on the 7th floor of the J. Edgar Hoover building, he's a desk cop, not a street cop. And when the shit hits the fan, you don't want a desk cop coming to your rescue. By the way, if you're a Homeland fan, wipe Saul Berenson out of your head. Brennan ain't no Berenson. He's been pushing papers around his desk his whole career, at least when he's not out in the hallway hoping to bump into someone to whom he can whisper his top-secret garbage like the Steele dossier. For months, he was hyping the dossier to just about anyone who would listen. In July 2016, he tried to get the FBI to investigate the Trump campaign, but Cardinal Comey turned a deaf ear. Back then, the Cardinal, another desk cop, was too busy neutering the investigation into Hillary's emails to buy the crap Brennan was selling. One conspiracy at a time, please. That's when everyone was sure she was going to win. Remember? That August, Brennan went over the Cardinal's head directly to President Obama. According to the Washington Post, a story based on leaks that just might have come from leaker Brennan himself, the CIA was the only intelligence agency present at that briefing. Brennan was still the only member of the intelligence community who was publicly saying that Russian President Vladimir Putin was trying to get Donald Trump elected. At that time, none of the other agencies bought Brennan's fairy tale. I don't even think the writers of Homeland would have been interested. Still, Brennan wouldn't quit. Like a one-man band with an accordion on his chest and cymbals on his knees, he made as much noise as he could. He next went to Congress and briefed leaders from both parties. He didn't get much traction there either. Desperate, he took his story to the one person of any note who would believe him. Minority Leader Harry Reid was at the end of his career in the U.S. Senate. The 2012 midterm elections had rendered old Harry about as politically impotent as Anthony Weiner. Sorry, couldn't help myself. Literally adding injury to insult, he'd smack himself in the eye with an exercise band and was walking around with one lens of his glasses covered in duct tape. Okay, I'm joking. It wasn't duct tape. And I don't mean to make fun of the senator's injury. I just wanted to set the scene. But it is true that Senator Reid was doing just about anything to make himself relevant. When Donald Trump became the Republican nominee and was therefore eligible to read the classified daily briefs given by the intelligence agencies, Reid wanted intel analysts to send Trump phony briefs. I kid you not. So, when liar Brennan cornered Harry and spewed his cooked-up tale about Putin and Trump, the minority leader swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. Reid sent a letter post-haste off to the FBI director urging him to open an investigation. Cardinal Comey didn't open one, at least that the public knew about. He was still too busy fudging crooked Hillary's investigation. 2 months later, Senator Reid pounded the keys on his computer again, this time scolding the Cardinal for reopening the investigation into Hillary while not doing a thing about Putin's interference. Comey and the FBI responded, taking the official position that there was no clear evidence linking the Trump campaign to Russia. The Cardinal would eventually change that official position. He had a habit of doing that. Meanwhile, with Brennan as ringleader, the anti-Trump conspiracy's numbers began to grow. Unmasking the Unmaskers. On the day Donald J. Trump was sworn in as the 45th president, Susan Rice, Obama's last national security advisor, sat in front of her computer composing an email she was about to send to herself. Her purpose, she later said, was to create a permanent record of a meeting she'd had with Obama and his top national security advisors a few days before. The discussion at the meeting centered on how much of their investigation into the phony Russian collusion story they were willing to share with the incoming administration. So let me try to get this straight. Obama's NSA chief wanted a permanent record of the outgoing president's directive to keep national security information secret from the incoming president? However, just because it's in an email doesn't make it any less a lie. What is it with the deep state that they think putting words on a page magically makes them true? I guess Susan learned after lying about the spontaneous protest in Benghazi that it would be better to put her lies in an email. Second, Susan, the fact that you were conspiring against the incoming administration is simply more proof The shadow government was looking to control the intelligence community during the Trump presidency. In truth, your career is a testament to how one can rise in the government if lies are your stock in trade. What your actions say to me is that, at the very least, your allegiance to the country you swore to protect is suspect. At worst, you are plotting to take down the commander-in-chief. Liar Rice first waded into the swamp under Bill Clinton's administration. Bill's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, recommended Rice for a senior job in the State Department. Albright and Rice's mother had known each other for years. Rice was named the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. In that post, she stood by with the rest of the Clinton administration as the ruling Hutus conducted a mass execution of ethnic minorities in Rwanda. Rice was more worried about politics than the lives of 800,000 Tutsis and other minorities. Of all people, it was Samantha Power who would become Obama's UN ambassador and card-carrying member of the deep state who would expose Rice's true feelings about the Rwandan slaughter. In an article Power wrote for The Atlantic, she quoted Rice as saying, "If we use the word genocide and are seen as doing nothing, what will be the effect in the November congressional elections?" It was so callous and incendiary. The comment might have stopped Rice's government career in its tracks had the article not been published in September 2001. The events of 9/11 overwhelmed all other news coverage. Rice crawled deeper into the swamp in Obama's first presidential campaign as a national security advisor. After his election, Obama rewarded her with a plum job as United States Ambassador to the United Nations, the same job he would give Samantha Power, ironically, which turned out to be a complete disaster. Out of her depth, Ambassador Rice failed to get either Russia or China to join the U.S. to deal with Syria or to impose sanctions against Iran. Rice's most memorable moment during her time at the U.N. had nothing to do with her role as U.S. ambassador. I'm sure you remember. On September 16, 2012, the Obama administration needed to go on television to explain the deaths of a U.S. ambassador and three others 6 weeks prior to the 2012 presidential election. The White House wanted Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, and the natural person to comment and explain on the Sunday morning talk shows to tell the lie, which she would end up telling repeatedly, but that day she was nowhere to be found. Several officials, including Ben Rhodes, reached out to her, but Hillary had either gone into hiding or was busy planning a cover-up at the highest levels of government and bungling foreign policy. There's only so much you can ask from one woman. And so, Susan Rice ended up doing what is known as the full Ginsburg interviews on all five Sunday morning news shows. On each of those shows, she looked right into the camera and told us the September 11 attack, 5 days earlier on our diplomatic compound in Libya, was a spontaneous reaction to an anti-Muslim YouTube video. She told us that, and yet she knew full well it was a premeditated terrorist attack. When the deputy chief of the Libyan mission, Greg Hicks, heard Liar Rice on the Sunday shows, he couldn't believe his ears. Hicks was the last person to speak with Ambassador Chris Stevens before he was murdered during the attack. He had firsthand knowledge of what occurred in the Benghazi diplomatic compound. In emotional testimony in front of a congressional committee, Hicks refuted the Obama administration's version of events. "I was stunned. My jaw dropped. And I was embarrassed," he said about watching Rice's remarks on television. He was questioned for about 2 hours on the matter, giving a chilling, minute-by-minute account of the attacks. None of it sounded anything like the minor incident Susan Rice was peddling on television. He called it a demonstrably false narrative. The most emotional moment of his testimony came when he spoke of learning of Ambassador Stevens' death. He called it the saddest phone call I have ever had,